what we look at it, you know, it's a privilege to be in business. It's not, you know, just because you start a business doesn't mean you deserve to stay in business.
This is A New Angle, and I'm your host, Justin Angle, marketing professor at the University of Montana. This podcast is all about creativity and hustle happening in and around the great state of Montana. Thanks for tuning in. Today's interview is a really fun one. I sat down with Bjorn Nabosny, the co-founder of Big Sky Brewing. And I say co-founder, you know, we get right into it. He's not too keen on titles. He's just a guy that works at a brewery. And the story of Big Sky is stuff of legend, at least in my world at the College of Business here. I mean, they came out of the business plan competition and just have had tremendous success with their notable product. Moose Drool is just an iconic brand, particularly in the Northwest, but also I think they're distributed into 23 states now. And, you know, just really a Missoula company that is on the forefront of the craft brew industry. And it's fun to just sort of observe their success. Anyway, talking with Bjorn was super fun. We got into a couple of interesting issues. One, their approach to growth and how they make decisions, what constitutes a go decision, what constitutes a no-go decision, and then how that aligns with their kind of brand parameters. We also talked a lot about their philosophy of giving back to the community. They're an interesting company because they're tremendously embedded in the local scene here in Missoula, yet they're a company that kind of competes on a nationwide level. So the give and take between those two forces is kind of interesting. And then finally, in the closing minutes of the interview, I was able to sort of get Bjorn to talk about the issue of drinking on college campuses and the role and responsibility that breweries have in that space, and you know, how they can do better, how policymakers can do better. So it was a really interesting interview. We got on a bunch of topics, and I really thank Bjorn for his generosity of time, but also his generosity of thought in the sense that he was willing to talk about a wide-ranging array of issues. All right, I'll turn you over to Bjorn Nabosny.
Bjorn, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So you are, you don't like titles, you're a guy that works at Big Sky Brewing.
Yeah, a guy that works at Big Sky Brewing.
One of the co-founders, we have to put that in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Listeners probably already know that. Yeah, so we've been chatting a little bit. You're, you know, like I said before, your origin story for this enterprise is the stuff of legend at the University of Montana and the College of Business. And that story's been told well. Yeah. You can look it up on the Big Sky Brewing website. But what we want to talk about today is sort of what's next. I mean, you're at this... the brewery has arrived in many ways. It's been established for a long time, but now you are, 26 states distributing in?
We're actually, our distribution area is actually 23 states.
23 states?
Yeah. We decided, it was a long process, but we decided to pull out of Texas at the end of last year.
Interesting.
Because it just wasn't profitable for us to sell beer there. The competition, there's so many breweries down there. I'd like to say the competition isn't the reason why we pulled out, but that's always the reason why you leave someplace.
Okay.
If you can't compete, don't.
Do you mean when you say competition, you just mean it's so dense or that others are making a better margin and you can't compete at price point?
Freight from Montana to Texas is enormous. And okay. So we couldn't figure out a way to make a reasonable margin on anything that we sold in Texas because of the freight component. We were subsidizing it so heavily to be positioned on properly on the shelf price wise that at the end where there was nothing left. We were actually losing money on after we really put a pencil to it on every case we sold.
But that's going to take a lot of kind of poise in an organization to make the conscious decision that pulling back is the right choice for the business. I mean, a lot of businesses get to that point where they're forced to do that.
Yes.
Seems like that wasn't the case here, but you made a strategic decision that pulling back from this particular market is the sound choice.
It was a tough decision. I think because your ego comes into play again on that. And it's like, how can we do this? You know, and it comes into volumetrics. You know, we'd have to exponentially increase our sales to Texas and the spending that would we had to, you know, it's the cart or the horse type thing. How do we how do we want to present ourselves in a market to grow the market? It, you know, it takes boots on the street, you know, which are very expensive. And Texas is, well, like Montana, a huge state.
Right.
And
big geography.
And with lots of people, unlike Montana. So it was attractive when you look at population, but then it becomes less attractive when you look at geography on that and the number of people that it would take to support to do the an appropriate amount of sales to get your freight in alignment with an allowable price point. But then you lose it all to labor on the other side. So yeah. It was one of those wrestling things that we just couldn't make it work. We left Texas with, you know, I thought our departure was great in that our network was very disappointed when we left. They're okay. Like, we want you to stay. Huh. And we're like, but it doesn't make sense. And then we're like, okay, we understand. But if you come back, we would love, we had to take your brand back.
Uh-huh. So the bridge is not burned?
No, not at all. No.
To make it work in a market like that, at that distance, would you have to look at sort of bottling or producing down on location and expanding in that way or contracting with a partner?
I think that's an option, but the inherent problem with that, it changes the authenticity of your brand.
Right. Okay.
You know, it changes the story of we're a Montana brewery. And I think what we represent is, as a Montana brewery is we have great clean water, you know, the Big Sky. You know, we named Big Sky Brewing Big Sky Brewing. It had nothing to do with selling beer inside the state. There's Big Sky everything, you know, in Montana already. So there wasn't anything unique about that. What it is it's a great descriptor about who we are. And you hear it from folks when they come to Montana. It's like, yeah, the sky is bigger. and I don't know why, but it seems bigger when you're here. And so part of it, I think an essential part of our brand and any brand is that authenticity and an honest message. We are a Montana beer. This is how we live, where we live, where it's produced.
Sure.
And so I think that's that it, at least, you know, maybe that'll change in the future. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But for now, it really doesn't make sense for us to make beer anywhere else.
Yeah. And we've seen that authenticity in the craft brew space is such a needed brand attribute.
Yes. And when you look at authenticity now as craft, it's gotten pretty gray. It's hard to tell who is craft, who is a multinational mega corporation owned, you know, brewery. And the thing that what I think the underlying thing about craft and myself, the most important thing is that there's quality. There's consistent. It's a consistent quality beer that I can enjoy. I used to gravitate towards style. Now when I'm drinking a beer, regardless of whose beer it is, I'm looking for quality. I want a quality experience regardless of where the beer is made. But I think when we look at it right now, who makes it is becoming more and more important. Mm-hmm. When we look at a number of our competitors that we're competing, you know, that we're competing directly with, there's our indirect and our direct competitors, and a number of our direct competitors are now wholly owned by either Anheuser-Busch, which would be ABI,
right.
Miller Coors, or a holding company. So the dollars change the landscape, I think, with regards to effectively competing against these folks. It's very hard to compete against a multinational, as it turns out.
Yeah, you guys are doing it.
Yes, we're doing it. We're just trying to stay edgy and be ourselves. And when people are going left, we try to go right. You know, so it's... So we kind of march to the beat of a different drum.
Right. And so you've said that before, like when you guys are expanding into new markets, you're competing against companies that are a lot bigger than Big Sky. Yeah, you have Moose Drool and a few others that are these iconic brands, particularly in the Northwest, that people sort of assume you're bigger than you are.
Yes. Yeah. And which is nice going into a new market.
Because
you carry some clout.
Right.
And so we get there. And we're already known. So we're not having to build the brand recognition necessarily when we enter a new market, which is wonderful. You know, when having a brand like Moose Drool, you know, it's silly, it's iconic, it's whatever, but it's when you go in, the cost of entering a market, for as close as I can equate it to, is about 10 times, it costs 10 times more to garner new customers as it does to maintain our current customer base. So it gets less expensive the closer we get to home to maintain our market presence. And jumping in new markets is very scary because all of a sudden you're allocating dollars that you, on a guess and a hope that you're going to compete successfully there. Texas, it didn't work. But we had the fortitude to make the right decision and say, yeah, this isn't working for us.
What does that process of entering a new market look like? I mean, are you buying into distributing? Are you, what's that process look
like? Well, for us, you know, in the alcohol industry, we have a three-tier system. So we have the separation of manufacturing, distribution, and retail. That was as a result of the end of Prohibition. We split the feds decided that the best course of action was to split it all up so there couldn't be a potential monopoly in any market. That's gotten a little bit gray again. In the alcohol industry, we work in the gray a lot, so you'll hear me say gray quite a
sure.
bit.
Sure, nothing wrong with gray.
But now what you see is a lot of crossover. Breweries are selling beer in on their premise. Mm-hmm. Breweries will self-distribute. And so we've got facets of production, retail sale, and wholesale sale that are coming under the umbrella of individual breweries. And so it when we look at how we, you know, say go into a market and we look at those facets of it, is as we jump into say Minneapolis. I mean, we've been selling beer in Minneapolis forever, but what you look at there is the regulatory environment is one of the first things that we look at.
Sure.
When we look at a market. Also, taking big data now. Big data didn't exist when we first started this thing, but where are people coming from? Who's visiting Montana? And so we're taking kind of rifle shot approaches. We look at demographics. We look at our visitors, and then we go, all right, let's give it a go there.
Okay.
And so we take a rifle shot approach to our market. And
so interesting, looking at tourism data to get hypotheses about, okay, you know, if in 1 year or in a period of years, a lot of people from who knows where, Alabama, are coming to Montana, Missoula, Glacier, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe that's a reason to go into Alabama.
And because what we'll do is, and the kind of the thought behind that is when you kind of correlate your data to their market visits, what we want to do is give them a piece of Montana when they get home. And so they can remember when we were in Glacier,
sure,
or down in Yellowstone, and then they find our beer. They had our beer, and then they want to bring it home or get it when they're there.
Yeah, and that highlights the importance of that authenticity we just spoke about.
Yes. So it all kind of it's really funny because it all seems to keep coming back in full circles, from how we produce the beer to how we sell the beer to where we market the beer. It just keeps coming in a full circle, and we have to be genuine at every step of the way.
Yeah, and so looking at Missoula right now, I mean, 15 breweries in town?
We have 15.
And although nationwide, it's maybe an inflection point in the industry where craft is under some pressure?
Yeah, within different areas. You know, when we look at Montana, by midsummer, I'm anticipating 90 in Montana. Well, 15 in Missoula. But let's jump over to, I was just in California. There's 900 breweries in California.
Wow. Yeah.
And there'll be over 1,000 here in pretty short order. What's happened is not just with craft beer, but there's been the local movement of people wanting locally produced produce, locally, you know, mm-hmm. locally produced beef, beer. And which is cool. I think it's really fun because I love going to breweries, and so it doesn't hurt my feelings a lot that there are 15 breweries and about to be 15 breweries in Missoula. But from the consumer standpoint, it's awesome.
Sure.
From the business standpoint, what it does is it can be the potential to have death by 1,000 paper cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And typically and in the average in the United States right now is for a brewery will sell roughly 700 barrels of beer on premise, on their own premise per brewery. That's 1,400 kegs. So 1,400 kegs are coming out of distribution.
Wow.
So that's coming out of, and the pie is finite. And so we're not looking at an infinite market here. We're looking at slicing the pie up in thinner slices. And that comes at the expense of bars, which mm-hmm. are our customers, mm-hmm. Restaurants and other folks. So,
sure.
So that the slicing is where the paper cuts happen, because what you end up doing in the bars and other and taverns will feel this. They're feeling the crunch on that other side as there's a proliferation of breweries. So it's a very interesting dynamic. On one side, it's neat from a consumptive standpoint. You can see the dynamic of the market. The free market is saying this is what we want. But being in such a heavily regulated industry, the reaction side is, you know, the governmental side of the market is really slowing it down. And it doesn't allow for the bars and the taverns to adapt as quickly as I think they could otherwise.
Right. So I'll put you on the spot a little bit. Are there key regulations that are in the way?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they're the ones that, you know, in our industry, you don't want to talk about. You know, it's okay. Like, because it's, you know, one thing, it gets scary. Nobody wants to talk about one of the quotas in Montana. We have a quota system on liquor licenses and alcohol licenses in the state of Montana. So we have this artificial market that's been created in, you know, in Missoula, for instance. There a license is if I want a full service liquor license with gaming. Now there's gaming and no gaming. Gambling is a big
right
pivot on that too. If you're gonna pay $750,000 for a license,
just for the license, yeah,
and so. And at its peak, it was over, you know, one had peaked out a couple of years ago.
And that's on the secondary market. That's not that lottery system.
That's on the secondary market.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah. And so we have this artificially high market, which a lot of folks, unfortunately, have banked their retirement. They've banked their livelihood on this asset that really shouldn't exist in a free market sense. It doesn't make sense. It's so restrictive. But it's also keeping out a number of great restaurants that could
sure.
restaurants or bars or
yeah,
taverns
yeah.
that could exist in, because the lack of them, you know, the state has decided a number of years ago that it got to decide how many licenses an individual market could bear
uh-huh.
as opposed to letting the market do it. I'm a free market guy.
No, so and then now they've created this artificial bubble in a sense
yes.
that there's, you know, if they were to open it up, you know, they devalue all these licenses that exist in the marketplace that people, like you said, have built their kind of portfolio around.
Yeah.
The path to unwinding that out without just dropping a bomb in the economy of the
state.
Oh,
it'd be a disaster. So now we're kind of stuck in this mode.
Stuck, yeah.
But the breweries, there's no restriction on the number of breweries in a market.
Yeah.
So what you see is more breweries. The proliferation of breweries, because one of the, you know, if I wanted to have an alcohol serving establishment, the easier path is actually starting a brewery right
really?
Now.
Yeah.
Again, which I think is neat and interesting, but you know, it's just a market. It's as a result of overregulation that we see the market always finds a way.
It does.
And so it's found this way that if I want to be in the industry, I'm going to get there.
Yet, I mean, if you're entering this craft brew space, I mean, it's very product centric. You got to
yes.
have a good product.
Got a good product.
And
yeah.
so if your mission is to be a restaurateur and you can't do that because of the regulations, so you decide I'm going to open up a brewery.
Yeah.
Is that coming from a genuine place of craft?
Well, I think a good cook is a good cook in a lot of senses. And so, you know, so I think what you know, and there's no restriction against food. You know, in a brewery,
yeah,
so you can
yeah.
you can have that component, but but the alcohol component is important for a lot of foods. Beer and wine pair very well with foods, and if you can't have it, it really hampers your ability to be an effective restaurateur or
mm-hmm.
or whatever on that side of the coin. And so, what we see in other states is I see a balancing where the licenses are less restrictive. Washington State is a great example.
Yeah.
I think you see the success on both sides because there's not this artificial market that's been created. You know, we kind of got off on a tangent on this, but I mean, it's so important to our business at the local level, or the businesses that we do business with.
Sure.
Because it is a real sore spot. You know, there we've got roughly 2,700 bars in the state of Montana, and or licenses, I should say, and there could be more, but maybe there'd be less if the market were freed up.
Right.
Who knows? We can't know that, because I know that in a lot of places the value of somebody's retirement is they're holding out on that license, on the salability, but you still need a job until you reach retirement. So maybe there'd be less bars. I know, yeah, in some markets there would be, but it's really interesting, that whole dynamic and how really it affects the psyche of Montana brewers, mm-hmm, Montana tavern owners, Montana, you know, just the alcohol industry in general in Montana.
Sure. And so you guys, like we said, are in 23 states now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is your sole brewing facility.
Yes.
And so how close to capacity are you with this facility?
Well, it depends on the time of year.
Sure. Okay.
And so again, Montana, very, very tourist driven. And so what we have is a double dip in our sales cycle per year. So we have our shoulder seasons, the fall and the spring, which, mm-hmm, end up being slower. And so we have plenty of excess capacity. We never have enough capacity in the summer. So we try to build our capacity on optimizing for basically a 3-month period.
Okay.
And so
that's
right
tough
now,
to do.
Yeah, it's really tough to do. Yeah. Cause right now we have, okay, we're coming into kind of the dip, you know,
mm-hmm,
well, we're in the dip right now, because right after Christmas, you get, everybody has their New Year's resolutions and whatnot, and everybody's broke. And so our sales slow down. And then as we come in, so we see a big dip through February, and then we start coming out of it. I shouldn't call it a spring dip. It's more of a winter dip, but we start producing for summer and ramping up our production, in the end of February, given our lead times on production. So we'll start ramping up, and then we hit our peak. The peak beer selling period is actually July, but we actually hit our peak in the end of May, because we're upstream.
Writing orders.
Yeah. So we're filling all the orders to hit the market. And so we peak out end of May, beginning of June.
That's got to present some cash flow.
It does.
Interesting.
It really.
You're stocking up and ramping up production, labor, supplies.
Yep. And there's a delay. In the process or in the chain of things. So it's fascinating. You know, once you adapt to what we started doing, interestingly enough, we expanded into a southern tier of states,
okay,
to try to offset.
Oh yeah, offset that. To offset seasonality function.
Yeah. So we did offset that for a while, but as we grew, it came back because you still have the cyclical nature of the northern tier of states. We haven't escaped that, because the pull in the southern, you know, the snowbirds and whoever heads south, there's not a strong enough pull. They drink in December, January,
sure,
February, but the uptick isn't as great as I'd hoped, you know, for that.
So are these things that, you know, you sort of figure out as you go, or do you have hypotheses about these sorts of dynamics?
It was a guess when we first started doing it. But then following that, it's like you realize quickly, oh yeah, yeah, our guess, we were right.
Sure.
And there's not a lot of information to look at the offset of a southern selling strategy in the winter versus northern in the summer, because, you know, a lot of people, I think within the because, well, I think mainly because the strategy is one that's been relegated for the real large breweries, the multinationals and the huge folks. They're like, oh, I see this.
Right.
And we're still really too small to really benefit immensely from it, but we do see it. We, mm-hmm, do see that little bit. And just that little bit just helps bring you through the winter. And
right,
so just
right,
any type of smoothing effect, and anything that we can do to fill the tanks, that, you know, if we have, it always just pains me if you have one tank just sitting empty. You're like, oh,
missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
But not, you're not at the stage where, you know, another facility or adding on to this is on the menu.
No, not right now.
Yeah. No, and you've said before, like, you're thoughtful about the growth trajectory you have for this enterprise.
Yes.
And so what does that look like? How do you sort of conceptualize what growth means to you, what it should mean to the business?
What I look at business as, is specifically ours, you know, we look at, and pertaining to beer and alcohol, it's one of the oldest known industries, mm-hmm. you know, next to prostitution and politics, you know, there's alcohol. And they all kind of intermingle. We don't know who's first. We'll figure that out at some point.
Let the regulators decide.
Yeah, let them, they can regulate. Yeah. And so we look at that, and we're an old industry. We are thousands of years old.
Sure.
And it seemed to me when earlier in our stage, we were in a rush to grow. It was like, grow, 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 grow. And as we've matured and as we're very fiscal responsible with our company, we're very good with money. Mm-hmm. And as we've established ourselves, okay, we established our brand, we established our company, we stabilized. And we look at what do we want? What do we want as a company? Do we want to be the largest craft brewer in the United States? Is that our goal? No, that was never a goal.
Sure.
And so, okay, so if that's not a goal, what is it? And we're like, okay, let's step back. And this has become more of a mosey for us, you know. It's kind of like, let's walk along, let's progress, let's not stop, you know, doing interesting and fun things with our brand, but we can de-emphasize the need for double-digit growth. And we've stated, you know, as kind of as a growth plan for the next, over the course of the next couple of years is, you know, if we can grow at 3%, we're good.
Yeah.
We're golden.
Yeah.
And it's sustainable. I would rather grow at 0 to 3% growth per year over the course of 10 years than to have 20% growth for 1 year and
all kinds of volatility.
Yeah, the volatility, and then three, you know, for five straight years have 2 or 3% of decline. It's not fun.
And so what was the process like coming to that realization? I mean, I would think in the early days you're lean, you're hustling, you're just trying mm-hmm. to make this thing go, and then you have some success that's pretty aggressive, and then, you know, you come to this point now where you have this maturity of your perspective.
I think where that happened for us was as a team sitting back and looking at who we are. What did you know, ego is a very, very powerful thing.
Right.
And that's always comes to be part of the formula. And we're like, where are we? You know, what is our ego, you know, say we need to be? Do we need to be huge? Mm. And I think that helped us make, when we were like, no, we don't need to be the largest. We don't need to be these things that a lot of what other American businesses are looking at as tech is looked yep. at rapid yep. growth. Everything is
growth.
Yeah, it's slanted towards this huge growth model. And we're like, that doesn't fit us. What fits us is a profitability model. So, you know, sustainable growth, sustained profitability, and taking out any of the really, you know, relaxing the I think the ebb and flow of our day in and day out business was drove us to the decision, like, let's slow down.
Sure.
Let's be real with who we are, and let's look at this take the long view.
Right.
On our approach to selling and pretty much everything that we do at our company.
Yeah, so that clarity of purpose and kind of poise in the way you operate, I mean, it seems like you have a similar clarity with regard to your commitment to this community.
Yeah.
Big Sky supports so many important causes, events, organizations. You're just such an important presence in this community. What's been your kind of guiding philosophy about that?
Well, and it kind of goes back to our origins again with the company. What we look at it, you know, it's a privilege to be in business. It's not, you know, just because you start a business doesn't mean you deserve to stay in business.
Right.
And we looked early on as, you know, as having the privilege of doing business in Missoula, Montana. What does that mean to us? We're like, well, it means that we're part of the community. And how are you a part of the community is, well, you give back to the community.
Sure.
And you encourage growth and development of your community. That's, again, one, sustainable, but also, this is a great place to live. How can we influence as Missoula grows to keep this greatness about us, you know, within our, you know, we look at our, right now we've been on the trail kick for the last couple of years of building trail for mountain biking and hiking and running. And that's what we saw, you know, is we identify a problem within the community and we try to change it. And we look at a community need, and particularly for young people, when we look at, we want to, I think the prevalence of computers and video games and all that stuff, I don't want to be one of those guys like, oh, video games, they're the evil that haunts us right now.
Right.
But what you see is a lack of movement in youth, and I think if you're not moving, if you're not active, as kids and as adults, we can't stop moving ever, you know, because when you become sedentary, you just, it changes everything, you know,
right.
just blah, you know? And I was like, if you don't move, at some point you can't move. I'm going on a kind of diatribe.
That's okay. That's important stuff.
Kind of the roundabout way about this is like, how do we do this? How do we help people move and not look like Camel Joe to the youth, like we're selling beer to the youth. Hey, you should, we built this skate park, so you should drink our beer. Mm-hmm. Well, what we ended up doing early on is we were like, with the different physical projects that we're working on, like, just don't put our name on it. We don't need to be attached to it in that way. But what we can do is we could support it. And what we ended up, it had been 12, 13 years ago, where we decided a good avenue of supporting our community was through music. The music scene was pretty poor in Missoula, and we're like, wow, we had this big backyard here.
Sure.
And we're like, we could throw a show and do it as a fundraiser. Let's get a big band. And initially we thought we could get Pearl Jam to play in our backyard, big Pearl Jam fan. I'm so glad they're coming this summer.
Yeah. Maybe we can get them this summer.
But
at a date.
But Jeff Amet, actually, through a close friend, Truxton Rolfe, we kind of worked through, and he gave us some guidance early on and helped us figure out how we do this.
Sure.
And we found out that we couldn't do this ourselves. So we ended up working with some different music promoters, and they were on board with our vision of, and we can't sell the beer. And so in our backyard, so what we do is, the idea was always, it's going to be a nonprofit that's going to sell the beer and benefit from get the benefits of the beer sale.
Cool.
And then that supports a physical project. And what we always decided was 100% of the proceeds have to go to that physical project. We don't want to support administration. Mm. We don't want to support this thing. We want the thing built.
Yeah. And you have some leverage to dictate those kind of terms.
And so, which is nice. So over the course of the last dozen years, we've, you know, help build Brennan's Wave, the Mobash Skate Park. I ride for Tanner, multiple trail systems in and around Missoula. We've worked with the ice rink, then the Children's Historical Museum. We bought two buses, you know, through music with them. So we've done a lot. So that music component's really become a very large philanthropic wing for us that really we can go in and go, we can identify the need and go, all right, let's go after it. And we get to have a great party in our backyard at the same time.
Yeah. And so along those lines, you know, the philanthropic commitment seems largely based on wellness, activity, education, children. And so, you know, how does how do you and your partners kind of view your responsibility in terms of wellness? So what I'm thinking of is, you know, alcohol on college campuses and things like that. I mean, this is going to be a really salient issue for a company like yours.
Yeah, it's tricky when you especially when we look at people that are, well, looking at our local campus. We got involved last year with the University of Montana,
right? The Grizz Lager,
yeah, and
big success.
Yeah, it was a little bit tricky in that. The emphasis, what we wanted to do with that beer, as we were discussing it with the University of Montana, was to take a beer, and there's a little bit of backlash on it.
Yeah.
But the intent of it is, okay, what we sell our beer to people that are of legal drinking age, mm-hmm. you know, sure, people underage get that, but that's, it's illegal. So, sure. So we're looking specifically at the legal component of this, and we have youth that live on our campus, but they're not youth, they're young adults. They're, you know, mm-hmm. that drink downtown. And so we looked at this and like, let's support the bus, you know, help pay for the bus to get people to and from campus safely on the weekends. Let's help support alcohol education and awareness on campus. And the third component of that was scholarships. Because, you know, the university has found itself in a position where work funding is, well, very tight. Yeah. And this was our way of going, all right, we have an opportunity to support the education side. You know, this wasn't focused at athletics at all. So much of the focus of the University of Montana has been on athletics. Mm-hmm. And we wanted our focus to be on the other side.
Sure.
And because, well, the vast majority of us that either run or are part of Big Sky Brewing Company are university alumni. And so we wanted to also, you know, give back to our alma mater. And so it was a way for us to give back.
Yeah, it seems like the right way to configure it too. I mean, the thought you put into it and the arrangement.
I think so. And unfortunately, we'd had hoped that the licensing was going to go longer.
Uh-huh.
But there was some controversy on the athletic side with regards to a sponsorship that they've got from Miller Coors.
Sure.
And so the university has decided to end our licensing early, which is. And to me, it's kind of silly because what they in essence have done is just like, we don't want your money. We are in a fiscal conundrum, but we don't want this pile of money. The royalty that we paid was it put us in like the I think number two position for the University of Montana. We're talking big dollars.
Yeah,
we're I think it had this. Gotten some time to develop, and there's the really heavy cyclical nature of this. But you know, we're talking, I don't know, $60,000 to $100,000 per year of royalty. So we're big money on that. But on the bright side, it was a lot of fun, mm-hmm. and I think we did some positive stuff with the University of Montana and helping support some. Underfunded programs.
Right. You know, kind of going a little deeper into that, I wonder about, so I listened to this podcast this morning, and this woman who had just written a book about sexual assault on campus had a variety of guidelines for recommendations for policy changes. And mm-hmm. one of the things she recommended was lower the drinking age to 18 years old.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. And at first I thought, well, okay, let's explain this. And her premise was that on campuses, you've got this arbitrary kind of 21-year-old cut point that cuts the population in two. Now, everybody on campus is drinking, but some of them it's illegal. And it kind of, for those that for whom it's illegal, it kind of glorifies the nature of getting your hands on alcohol.
Yeah,
and so,
getting away with it.
Yeah, I mean, I know that's a little far afield of Big Sky, but you have thoughts on that? Like policy interventions to maybe create a healthier relationship with alcohol in our society?
It's tricky. I think, and I don't like to compare us to the United States, Europe, because we're not Europe. Mm-hmm. We are our own thing. But I think we've been rather irresponsible for 100 years on our perception of alcohol. And again, there needs to be some separation there too, because I think when we look at beer, I think Colorado has had a really good plan for years at the 3-2, you know, and then the graduation into the higher alcohol, you know, beverages. And I think it makes sense to some extent because all of a sudden you're 21, so you can go gangbusters.
Yeah, right? Go right down and get your Everclear.
Yeah, and so I think it's pretty tricky, but we need to put what's the interest of the young people ahead of what we think, you know, should, I guess, either our, I mean, this gets really deep because they say never talk about politics and religion, and this involves both of those. And so I'm trying to word this without
being... This is the perfect venue.
Yeah, because those things that you just, that it's... I think a lot of the stuff would be still unavoidable if we had a graduated process of bringing people into, you know, if they choose to drink. You don't have to drink. You know, that's not, right, you know, right. But it seems like societally, we've said unless you drink as a young person, quite often you're not part of this cool kids club getting away with something, yeah, whatever. And if I do it, I'm going to binge drink. And because I can't get this regularly, so I'm just going to,
sure,
you know, go hog wild on Saturday night with whoever I bought the booze from. We used to get it from bums, you know, give them an offer of a couple bucks. And
they get a commission.
give them a beer, whatever. But I think that it seems like I have to agree with her, because I think we've created an environment where people are binge drinking, and there's the end result of binge drinking is usually not it's not healthy.
No, bad stuff happens.
Yeah, and so if somebody gets overly intoxicated and loses control, does stuff that they wouldn't normally do.
Right.
When they had more temperance attached to it. That's tricky, though. That's a tricky, tricky subject without looking like an asshole.
You can say whatever you want.
Because I just really think that we need to mature in our approach to this.
I mean, like most things in our society, the truth is in the nuance. You gotta be thoughtful. And when people sort of just dig in on their various positions, I don't think you get much productive, creative, problem solving.
We need to have a real healthy, open conversation about alcohol and how we treat alcohol in the United States. And change I think the perception of one of the fortunate things that we see that youth is not drinking as much as it did when, say, I was a kid. Mm-hmm. There's a decline in drinking, underage drinking. But also what's coming with that is there's also a decline in young folks not having driver's licenses. And it was interesting. I read this article about a couple weeks ago. So it's talking about what youth aren't doing now. Mm-hmm. What they're not doing is they're not dating. Underage, sex is on the decline for youth. Drinking is on the decline. Smoking is on the decline. And waiting for driver's licenses. Huh. All that stuff I wanted when I was a kid. Yeah. And now it's like what the heck? Want to go chase girls and get as much beer on?
If they're not going after those things, what are they going after?
The difference has been apparently what the argument of the article was: social media has changed that dynamic.
Okay,
because they're interacting with each other on their computers and their phones rather than face to face.
Sure.
So what they say is people, they become more solitary in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, we'd have gathering spots. We'd go cruise, do whatever. And that's not something that happens any longer. Which is kind of a scary thing on one hand too, because we're a social being, we're social beasts, and isolating our youth, I think, and the exposure to the overexposure to social media, I think, is unhealthy, and in the bigger spectrum, because they're not communicating as real people. Facial expressions are important. Inflection in your tone is so important, and they're missing that. On the plus side, they're apparently writing more now than ever, because of texting and
right, different set of communication tools and norms emerge. Although that's one thing we've talked about, on this podcast before, is the sort of the magic that happens at a university is a lot of it is in that face to face direct communication. Online approximation of that can have other benefits that maybe we haven't even recognized yet, but it's definitely those statistics you cited say something about what our society's, where it's going. I'm not sure.
I don't know if it's good or bad.
Yeah.
Or
we don't know yet.
Cause we don't know. Yeah. We're in the middle of it.
It kind of is, right? I mean, you can't really unwind it.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think, the thing I love, and particularly when I look at my university experience, was the immersion of, I love the dorm experience.
Sure.
I thought that was good because all of a sudden you have within your group of friends when you're as a youth, you kind of have the same viewpoint. And all of a sudden you have this all these different opinions and ideas about stuff. And that was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It was really from a guy that came from a small town in Northwest Montana. It was shocking and awesome at the same time.
Sure.
And I think that's every bit as important as any of the classes I took.
Absolutely. Opening up your mind to all that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, Bjorn, you've been hugely generous with your time and insights. I know we pulled you a little bit off the standard script here, and I appreciate you going into those issues.
Yeah.
But more so, I appreciate just your commitment to this community and the university and just the thoughtfulness with which you bring to your daily operation. Thank you.
Thank you. I think, you know, from our team's perspective, it's been, like I said, it's a privilege. It's a privilege to be in business and to run a successful business. So it's been an honor to continue to be a force within the community. And I would argue that we're just getting started. You know, we've got a long ways to go watching the coming years of stuff that we hope to do to be impactful in a positive way.
Well, nice. Hopefully this podcast can survive a few more years and we'll have you back on to talk about what's happened.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Bjorn. All right. Hope you enjoyed that chat with Bjorn. I certainly did. And coming up next week, we have one that this one is pretty fun. I got to sit down with Rob Angel. Rob Angel is the creator of Pictionary, and it was a total random sequence of events that led me to the opportunity to talk to Rob. And that's kind of a key part of the interview, and it's super fun. The connection is that his children are students here. His daughter just graduated from the University of Montana last spring, and then his son is enrolled as a student at the Code School. And I think he actually probably has just graduated. So that's the connection with Rob. What an interesting guy, ton of energy, and the interview is super fun. So look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks for listening to A New Angle. We really appreciate it. Remember that A New Angle was brought to you by CED, Consolidated Electrical Distributors. They're one of the largest electrical wholesale companies in the country with nearly 600 locations nationwide. CED is a privately owned business-to-business company that distributes just about every piece of equipment to keep your lights on, your energy flowing, and your lifestyle comfortable. CED is also an important employer in Missoula, and they have a keen interest in University of Montana graduates. To explore career opportunities, check out www.cedcareers.com. Moving forward, if you have any suggestions for guests, cool people doing awesome things with creativity and hustle, please let us know. And if you enjoy this podcast, there are several ways you can support it. First, rate us on iTunes. Ratings help others find the show. Second, write a review. The more reviews we get, and hopefully positive ones, the more we can grow. And third, please just tell your friends about it. In addition, you can support A New Angle financially. For information on sponsorship opportunities, please visit our website, www.business.umt.edu/anewangle. There you will also find a link to support the pod. Before we go, I'd like to thank a few people for making this project happen. First of all, Elizabeth Willey, Communications Director here at the University of Montana College of Business. I'd also like to thank recent UM graduate Michelle DeFluke and our fabulous interns Savannah Sletton and Max Gibson. And a special thanks to VTO for providing the show with music. Finally, thanks to my producer, Stefan Borsum. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, insults, whatever, please email me at anewangle@umontana.edu. Help us spread the word and be sure to use the hashtag anewangle when you do. Thanks a lot and see you next time.